Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning in to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, August 28th. Unrest on the labor front, hotel workers shipped into high gear with strike preps, just as flight attendants with United announced results of their strike vote and set up informational picket lines in cities across the U.S. We hear the EPA's explanation of why it took experts hired by the Honolulu Board of Water Supply to flag that the Navy's water testing didn't follow proper protocol, resulting in false positives for petroleum hydrocarbons in the sampling. We learn about the 211 hotline that connects callers to local resources and service providers. And we hear about beginning life in an internment camp from a new memoir that's out. Plus, we introduce you to Hawaii Public Radio's new president and CEO who got behind the wheel this month. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At this hour, flight attendants from United Airlines are winding up an informational picket at Honolulu's airport. It's part of an event that's being staged across the country as we head into the busy Labor Day weekend. Hawaii's visitor industry is also facing the prospect of a strike by hotel workers. This morning, we hear from both unions. Kate Watanabe is head of Unite Here Local 5 that represents more than 5,000 hotel workers across seven hotel properties on Oahu and one on Kauai that have been at an impasse on contract talks. We talked to Watanabe this morning, who also represents airline caterers who just averted a walkout.
We narrowly averted a nationwide strike of our airline catering workers. We represent about 300 in Honolulu and Maui, part of a national contract. These are gate gourmet workers. They make all the in-flight meals. There was a strike threat looming as well for that, but we narrowly averted that. We actually just ratified that contract. It was just finalized like last week. So,
gosh, okay. Yeah. So that's new then. Obviously, we're looking to see what happens with these talks. And, you know, I recall, covering, that last big strike back in 1990, and that was huge.
Yep. This may be larger to some extent. This is definitely the largest mobilization of our members since 1990. 2018 resulted in a 51-day strike of our Kioia hotels, four on Oahu, one on Maui. On August 8th, seven Waikiki hotels voted to authorize a strike. Sheraton Kauai workers authorized to strike as well if needed. And so we now have eight hotels, over 5,000 workers that are mobilizing for a potential strike. So yeah, it's the biggest mobilization in over 30 years for us for sure.
Is that just because of the number of properties or the number of members?
Definitely both. I would say the other thing that we are dealing with, and I think we've talked about this before, is the changes in our industry are happening so quickly as it relates to ownership and operation of our hotels. We're dealing with the largest real estate investment trusts, REITs, and private equity firms today that own our hotels. And the big brands, Hilton, Hyatt, Marriott, operate these large properties. But, we have to deal with both owners and operators. But the other thing that has changed, I think, for us is the changes we've seen coming out of the pandemic, particularly related to workload and staffing cuts, are cuts that our hotel operators and owners have attempted to make permanent. And I think the difference is what is at stake in 2024 compared to 2018 is that we are seeing these changes all across our industry. And the big concern is whether or not we're going to have tourism that really works for us locals and tourism that works for our guests as well. Because the impact has not just been one on our hotel workers and hospitality workers, but it has also had a huge impact on the level and quality of service that our guests have come to expect and deserve when they spend their savings to come out to Hawaii and vacation. So it is not unusual for guests to have to wait 45 minutes in line at the Hilton Hawaiian Village to just check in. We have half as many bellmen at the Hilton Hawaiian Village, which is a 22-acre property, seven towers. So it's not unusual for folks to have to carry their own luggage or not enough luggage. There's not enough service. And all of the impacts we're dealing with as workers have a direct correlation to the level of service. And thus, the real concern, Catherine, I think, is really, what are we going to do to make sure we protect our brand? Tourism, hospitality is an important part of our economy. We depend on it as workers to provide for ourselves and our families. But at the same time, so many other people in the community rely on a healthy, robust tourism industry. And, you know, the industry is saying, well, this couldn't be a worse time. Airline workers, United workers, or, you know, our own members in Gate Gourmet were threatening to strike. Now we have hotel workers in Hawaii. And there's a lot of talk about the recovery and the pandemic. Well, the fact of the matter is that pandemic ended over 2 years ago. Our hotel owners and operators continue to make as much money today, if not more, prior to the pandemic. They're charging our guests even more and providing less service. And that is the concern that we have, right, as hospitality workers, are whether or not we're going to have the tools to continue to protect the special brand that is part of Hawaii's tourism market.
Well, you know, I was traveling recently in the Pacific this summer and didn't see daily room service, room cleaning. I was surprised to see a robot in one of the hotels as well. So I don't know how you're looking at, you know, the technological advances and then just the need for housekeepers, right, if they're foregoing daily room cleaning.
The fact of the matter is that if a room isn't cleaned every day and serviced every day, that work becomes that much harder when a guest actually checks out of their guest room. You know, it's not easy for room attendants to have to clean in our market in Hawaii, not just the rooms, but the lanais, and deal with the outside elements and sand and families, etc. We welcome our guests. We want our families to stay. But the ability to provide the quality of service means that room attendants need to be able to service the room on a daily basis. And we had to fight, and we fought, and we have language in our contracts that provide daily room cleaning at all of our union properties. But you're absolutely right. Where there is no union, where there's no contract, daily room cleaning may be an optional service, which I think has a huge impact on, again, our brand. You know, our guests save up. They travel at least 5 hours on a flight, and you know, they deserve to get their rooms cleaned. Don't we all expect that? That was a given. When we would stay at a hotel, nobody thought of our rooms not being cleaned and serviced every night. And today that has totally flipped. Our industry has taken advantage in so many different ways of consumers and workers. And what we're seeing in our hotels is exactly what we have seen in the airline industry as well. And so I think it is sort of a interesting convergence of issues with United Airline workers having potentially authorized a strike as well. While we have authorized a strike, you know, we are dealing with the same dynamics in some ways. Today, we pay for every single service, bags, carry-on bags, et cetera, no meals on flights. That is exactly what we're seeing in our hotels as well. And so that is the concern. If we're going to protect our brand, we want to make sure that as workers, we're not undermined. And that means that we need the proper staffing. We need the staffing to provide the guests that quality of service. And technology is an important part, or could be an important part of that. By no means are we opposed to it at all, right?
You know, when I was in Japan, I also saw self-check-in. You check into the hotel with a kiosk, and you just see it coming in various places.
Absolutely.
But what are the sticking points at this juncture?
Well, I'm glad you brought up technology. We have a national agreement on technology that doesn't stop technological advances or changes in our industry. The agreement basically puts forth a process so that workers who may be displaced by technological changes are taken care of, that our jobs are not just replaced by robots, but that more importantly, we're part of the process to make those technological changes work and help support the existing workers in the workplace rather than replace our jobs. That's important. We have the need to renew our agreement on daily room cleaning, which is an important part of issues related to workload. And that is the central issue at the moment. We have not gotten a reasonable response at all, in some cases no response on our proposal that we put forth starting back in April related to addressing our concerns on workload and staffing.
That was a Local 5 Financial Secretary and Treasurer Kate Watanabe talking about the contract dispute with hoteliers Hilton, Sheraton, and Hyatt on Oahu and Kauai. There is another labor dispute playing out at airports across the country. At this hour, the Flight Attendants Association for United Airlines is winding up an informational picket. Kevin Beatty is the president of the AFA Local Council 14. We heard from him this morning.
United Flight Attendants, we have about 25,000 flight attendants right now. We have a little over 300 flight attendants based in Honolulu. And we're out here today at the Daniel K. Inouye Airport and 19 other airports to announce the results of our strike authorization vote. United Flight Attendants voted 99.9% to authorize a strike if necessary. Recent strike authorization votes have propelled flight attendant negotiations forward at American, Alaska, and Southwest, resulting in tentative agreements at all three of those carriers within a matter of months after their strike authorization vote. And United Management, meanwhile, is still proposing concessions at the negotiating table while the airline rakes in billions in revenue and awards executive millions in bonuses. Our CEO made 229 times more than the median United employee. It's unacceptable corporate greed, plain and simple. United flight attendants are demanding significant double-digit pay increases, pay for all time at work, including ground and boarding, retroactive pay to when our contract became amendable almost 3 years ago, and schedule flexibility.
I understand this is what the first strike vote that you folks have taken in almost 20 years.
Since 2005. Yeah, since 2005, 19 years exactly.
And boy, has the climate on airlines these days changed.
Well, you know, we work under the Railway Labor Act. It kind of restricts us compared to most unions. You know, we aren't allowed to just go on strike. First, we have to send out a strike authorization vote. We're under mediation right now. The National Mediation Board is assisting us with our negotiations. And if it gets to the point where we feel that there's an impasse, then we can approach the National Mediation Board and ask to be released. If they agree, then there's still a 30-day cooling off period before we can attempt to do self-help, as they call it. For the Association of Flight Attendants, we'd be implementing our chaos strike, which is we can choose to strike the entire airline or individual flights, and the union will be the one to determine when and how we will strike.
You folks are setting up these picket lines in advance of the Labor Day, the busy Labor Day holiday. But then, like you said, there may be some time before you can actually call a strike.
We're not calling for a strike right now. We would have to get to that point where we felt that there was an impasse. We'd have to reach out to the National Mediation Board. They would have to agree that there's an impasse, release us to the 30-day cooling off period. So we're really nowhere near actually striking right now. Today is informational picketing, as we've been doing every other month for the last year now.
But you would like to see some resolution since these contracts have been out there for the last couple of years.
Yeah, almost 3 years we've been in negotiations now. The good news is, like I said, at American, Alaska, and Southwest, all three of them did the same thing. They did strike authorization votes. They had a very high turnout, a very high yes for their strike authorization. And that led to tentative agreements at all three airlines within a matter of months. So we're hoping that United will understand the seriousness that flight attendants are demanding, that we get a contract that we can ratify in the foreseeable future and not have to wait years for it. Flight attendants need relief now. I'm not sure if you've seen some recent articles. There was one in the Washington Post about how flight attendants these days are having to work side jobs, and some of them are living in their cars. And especially for the junior flight attendants, they haven't gotten relief in a number of years. And we really need to get these improvements, especially for them.
That was Kevin Beatty, head of the AFA Local Council 14, who we talked to just before United Flight Attendants gathered for an informational picket this morning at the airport here on Oahu, one of 20 locations where members put up picket lines to draw attention to their labor dispute. The Red Hill saga and what's in the water took another turn this week. At Monday's Honolulu Board of Water Supply meeting, experts hired by the utility testified that the Navy's contractor failed to properly follow procedures in its testing and water sampling. The findings of Analytical Quality Associates and a Colorado consultant calls into question the levels of TPH, or total petroleum hydrocarbons, reported by the Navy. It also noted that the improper testing protocols weren't caught by the regulators. Neither the State Health Department or the Environmental Protection Agency flagged the error. Amy Miller is with the EPA's Region 9 Enforcement and Compliance Division. We spoke with her this morning about the concerns of the Water Board and community members regarding the discrepancy. While the Navy's vendor's misstep of not removing the chlorine from the water prior to testing may have skewed the results in that case, Miller, however, says it does not invalidate the other tests conducted on the 8th 5,000 samples taken for other contaminants. This is just the latest dispute after a fuel spill made its way into the Navy's drinking water.
We at EPA had received some complaints about the drinking water system and had looked into it. At the same time, we were seeing an uptick in total petroleum hydrocarbon results from the Navy's sampling under the long-term monitoring plan. As a result of that, the Navy put together a swarm team of experts to do a deep dive to look into what was that cause. And at that time, I believe they may have done a press release announcing their findings, including the fact that they had not been quenching the samples for chlorine, which is required under the method. And so at that time, they decided to put together the extended drinking water monitoring plan. And we have been providing significant technical input. We've also been trying to review the data more frequently in a quarterly basis. And in fact, we've reviewed the first round of data. EPA is also doing split samples to ensure the efficacy of the total petroleum hydrocarbon sampling. And we have done an inspection to do our own independent sampling and analysis. So there are many different activities we're doing to ensure that the Navy's data is accurate. And the whole purpose behind the extended drinking water monitoring plan is to ultimately be able to get to the point of being able to say that the drinking water system has recovered. So the additional year will provide sufficient data to get over this issue with respect to the quenching of the sample.
And when you say quenching, you're talking you use an additive to extract the chlorine out when you run the tests on it, correct?
Yeah, so the chlorine can interfere with the total petroleum hydrocarbon analysis. And so they eliminate the chlorine so that you can get an analysis that doesn't include chlorine, which can create detections of total petroleum hydrocarbons. Now, total petroleum hydrocarbons is a gross test. It's not a specific pollutant. It's a determination of whether or not there are petroleum hydrocarbons, which is a whole group of different constituents that can be in gasoline, diesel, all sorts of oily-based mixtures.
Well, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds for our listeners, but I think the concern is if the Navy's vendor, you know, didn't follow proper protocols, and even though it was spelled out, the Board of Water Supply was just concerned that neither the EPA or the Department of Health caught that in time.
So we had been reviewing the data, and one of the things that the long-term monitoring plan did not have within it was a requirement to do a deeper dive. And ultimately, what we want to know is whether or not there is any harmful constituents within the drinking water. And so the process that we've set up in the extended drinking water monitoring plan will require that when there is total petroleum hydrocarbons found. The analysis that was done under the long-term monitoring plan, we did review it often with sampling methodology. We expect that a contractor and a facility will comply with the methodology. Because of the concerns that have been raised during the long-term monitoring plan, we are planning to do a sampling audit in September to ensure that the current contractor who is collecting the sample is doing it according to method.
Okay, and I'm not sure. I know when we last talked to Admiral Mark Williams, I believe he said it was AECOM that was their contractor on some of the water testing. I don't know if that was the vendor that's involved with this.
I do know that AECOM is the vendor currently. I'm not certain as to who was the vendor previously. I would have to go back and ask our staff.
We hope then to get those results next month.
So we are doing this audit in September, and typically a lab audit report would be available within 60 to 90 days. If there's immediate corrective measures that need to be taken, the auditors will immediately notify the Navy of those measures. We will make data available when it's complete to the public.
And then is there anything else you can share with us? I know that at that meeting, there were some concerns raised about the lead that was found in some of the testing.
So one of the other constituents, and so this whole concern about removing the chlorine from the total petroleum hydrocarbon analysis doesn't impact the other analysis that was done. Those were done according to method and appropriate quenching. So the lead samples that were taken during the long-term monitoring plan, there were detections, and per protocol, the Navy did remove the fixtures because that's the most common source of lead is old fixtures that were made with lead, and then retested, and there was no detect on those lead samples.
Okay, and we'll just have to keep monitoring that.
That's correct. And, you know, under EPA's regulatory requirements for lead and copper sampling, which the Navy does, separate from the extended monitoring plan and separate from the long-term monitoring plan, they have to continue to do their required drinking water samples. They have to do lead and copper sampling, and part of that requires them to do a sampling of tap. In the long-term monitoring, they are sampling every single resident for lead and taking immediate action. And so there has been some benefit of having these lead samples and addressing immediately the fixture issue.
That was Amy Miller, who was with the EPA's Region 9 office out of the San Francisco area, the Office of Enforcement and Compliance. She was talking to us about the latest dispute in the testing of the Red Hill water system.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Under Taliban rule, Afghan girls can't study past the sixth grade. But one woman defies that law and continues to run a high school for young women.
I am still standing, and I will continue to stand, whether anyone supports. I will be with the women of my country until the very end.
That story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1, here on HPR 1.
Most people are familiar with 911 emergency calls for police or fire, but 211 is a helpline that you can call for community resources. HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pope joins us this morning to look at recent trends. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so, I mean, I know I have the 311 app on my phone to report potholes, but what did you find when you were taking a closer look at 211 calls?
Yeah, so if you've never called 211 before, one way to think of it is like a search engine that you access by phone. So the hotline has a database of 4,000 local resources, and their service providers, when you call, try to connect each caller with something that meets their needs.
There was a lady who called because there was a kupuna lady who seemed lonely. And, you know, she worked in a store, and this kupuna lady would come in, and she just seemed really lonely. And so she called us to see if there was any organizations that had, you know, kupuna events and activities that she could help her get into. And just stories like that, where it's people helping people. I think that's what we're all about in Hawaii. And that's what we do at 211.
So that's Jennifer Peacher. She's the hotline's VP of Community Response Program. She told that story to kind of illustrate that this one of the surprising reasons why someone might call 211. She says people call for all kinds of reasons. She told me this other story about a woman who called in because her kid wanted to learn how to ride a bike, but she herself had never learned how to ride, and so she didn't know how to teach her kid. And so 211 actually connected them with a resource so that they could learn together.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, those just kind of touch your heart.
Yeah. And those are some of Jennifer's favorite calls. But she says that not all the calls that 211 gets are so lighthearted. In fact, people are usually calling in on their worst day. They're worried that they can't make rent or put food on the table or keep the lights on. Here's Jennifer talking about those calls.
The top three requests are always rent, utility, and food. So rent assistance or housing assistance, utility assistance, and food assistance. Now, they kind of interchange in the top three. In 2023, the top request was for utility assistance. For 2024, we're seeing that rental assistance bumped up to the top and utility assistance is second again. The folks that actually call us, about 35% of our callers are actually Kupuna. And so we really try hard to take the time to talk story with them and to really, you know, actually, you know, be there live to give them assistance and to support them with searching our database.
And Hawaii is a hard place to make ends meet on a normal day, but 211 also gets calls from people who are looking to like rebuild their lives after disaster. So they've received a lot of calls after the Maui fires.
And so what's the most common, I guess, call for help?
This year in 2024, it's folks looking for rental assistance, folks who may have trouble, they might be falling behind on their bills. That, of course, is complicated on Maui because that situation is so dynamic with their rental market. They say that after the fires, the hotline's call volume just skyrocketed. And at their peak, they answered 600 calls in one day from survivors. And they're still getting those calls every single day from people who are looking for help.
And what happens to folks who call 211 and let's say they don't get help? Maybe, you know, they don't have the information that they're looking for.
Right. So 211 does a pretty good job. They got 47,000 calls last year. And of those calls, there were about 3,000 people who they were told were no resources in the hotlines database that could help them. And 211 tracks those cases as well. They get marked down as unmet needs so that the hotline can better understand where the gaps are in services. And they actually share a lot of their data and make it public so that policymakers can identify those gaps as well. And they say one of the big gaps right now is that there were a lot of programs that were funded during the pandemic to help people with essentials like food, rent, and utilities. And now many of those programs have ended or they're running out of funds. And I've heard the same thing from other providers of services as well. So, for instance, I spoke to Nick Severson. He's an attorney with the Legal Aid Society of Hawaii. And he agreed that need is up, but assistance programs are down, and residents are kind of getting caught in the middle. They're spread really thinly trying to make ends meet. And, Catherine, when I was on the show last week, for instance, we talked about a program run by the Honolulu Office of Economic Revitalization and the Council for Native Hawaiian Affairs. They have these in-person events to provide people with rent and utility assistance. And both of those offices told me that every time they hold one of those events, it could be the last one because they're not sure how much longer their funding will last. But people are still applying. They're reviewing 159 applicants just from last Friday. So Jennifer says it's really frustrating for providers to be in this position where they have to turn people away because there aren't resources.
You know, the challenging part for us is that, you know, the need is still there. And when you're actually talking, you know, to someone, you know, these are our neighbors, right? We're talking to our neighbors and we're trying to help. But if there isn't anything that we can help them with, it's just, you know, for us as 211, as helpers, it's so disheartening.
Yeah, because you do want to, you know, connect people if you can, because they're really calling for help.
Absolutely. But when I talked to Jennifer and I talked to Nick, you know, they were very careful saying they don't want to discourage people from reaching out for help, even if there might be fewer resources to go around, because it's really important to try to get assistance as soon as possible if you're struggling, if you're behind on a rental payment or struggling to pay your utility bills. Getting some sort of assistance early on or being in contact with a legal professional can help you. That can help you avoid the worst outcomes of missed payments like utility disconnections or evictions. And what Jennifer has also said that they're trying to work with people on is, okay, maybe we can't give you, maybe you're not eligible for utility assistance, but maybe we can try to get you registered for SNAP benefits so that your food bills are a little lower and you can kind of reshuffle your expenses to make at least this next month work.
Yeah, well, kudos to the people who are manning those hotlines because, you know, like you said, there are folks that call when their most desperate moments, and to have that human touch on the other line is a great help. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. You can read more of her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses such as art, film, history, and gardening. Classes begin September 23rd. More by searching OLLIUHM.
You are invited to HPR Generation Listens Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and connect with fellow HPR fans. Gather your team of up to six public radio nerds and sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, celebrating 120 years in Hawaii and committed to advancing the state's clean energy goals. Annual sustainability reports at hawaiigas.com.
Kenichi Yabusaki is an Oahu resident and retired biochemist. He recently published his memoir entitled Gaman. In the Japanese culture, Gaman is the art of perseverance. And in his book, he details moments from his life, from being born in a World War II internment camp and growing up in the shadow of racist sentiment to serving in the military and raising a family in Hawaii. The Conversation's Russell Subiono sat down with Yabusaki in our studio recently.
You were actually born in an internment camp in Idaho, right?
Correct.
So can you talk about the circumstances that led to your birth in an internment camp in Idaho?
Yes, my family that was incarcerated after the attack on Pearl Harbor and the signing of Executive Order 9066 by President Roosevelt resulted in a mass evacuation of Japanese people, ancestry of Japanese, on the entire West Coast. So that would include Washington, Oregon, California, and then parts of Alaska as well. So anyway, we were put into, I wasn't born yet, but my family was my father, my mother, my maternal grandparents, and my sister, who was approximately 3 years old at the time. So they were all gathered and put into assembly centers. The one that my family was put into was called Camp Harmony, which is kind of ironic, but they were part of the Puyallup Fairgrounds at the time. And then, so they converted the horse stalls, modified them, and made the barracks for all the people that were going to the camps. And then from Puyallup, the camp that they were destined to was Minidoka, Idaho.
Was your family living on the west coast of the U.S. at the time?
Yes.
And that's how they ended up there?
Okay. Yes, they were in Seattle, Washington.
How long was your family in internment camps? Do you have any memories of living there?
No, they were put in there approximately 3 years. I was born at near the end of the war in September of 1944. So it lasted until August when the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I was there just less than 1 year, and then they were released.
Where did your family go after they were released?
They went back to Seattle.
Did you pretty much grow up in Seattle?
Yes, I did.
I think the story of the internment camps, at least in Hawaii, at least on the West Coast and within the Japanese-American community, they're pretty well known. I think many wonder how the thousands that were sent to camps managed to get through such a painful time. In your book, you reference the Japanese practice of gaman as the practice that underlined how many endured that time. Can you talk about gaman?
Yes. Gaman is a Japanese cultural philosophy, if you want to call it, of enduring something without saying anything. So in other words, you hush up, you're in silence, and you endure whatever it is that you have to endure. The other attitude was in the book is called shogunai, which is cultural attitude of just, it can't be helped. You're feeling that it can't be helped, so you just, again, endure it. Those are the two main attitudes that were instilled in many Japanese families. The thing about gaman is that it wasn't necessarily practiced But because of the fear that was instilled in everyone by having to sell all your goods, you got to evacuate, you lose your business, all that. You only about 72 hours to do all that. So people didn't know where they're going when they boarded trains, and they didn't know what was going to happen to them. And so, yeah, it was a hard time for most people.
What led to the decision to write a memoir about your life? Was there something that you wanted to share with the world about what you had experienced and what you had seen in your time growing up?
Yeah, to be honest, Russell, I've been writing this memoir probably for years. The thing that catalyzed this whole thing was that I never knew about my parents, my grandparents. They never talked about their lives. So I wanted to ask things was, how was your childhood? How did you grow up? I never asked those questions. And that had a lot to do with the fact that you remain silent. And it was just, it's a cultural practice. We don't call attention to ourselves. You know, those are things you're instilled with. So I said to myself, geez, I don't know anything about my parents, my uncles, aunties, grandparents. So I said to myself, I've got to do something so that our children will know who I was, where I came from. So that's essentially why I wrote the memoir. Yeah.
The tagline for your book is "The Story of a Japanese American Prisoner in a War That Never Ended." Can you talk a little bit more about that, how the war never ended for some Japanese Americans?
Yes. Even prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor by the Imperial Japanese, the attitude, if you want to call it, of, quote, yellow peril existed at the time. People of Japanese descent who were farmers and good business people, whatever, they were doing quite well, actually very, very successful. And there was a lot of, I don't know if you want to call it jealousy or envy or whatever. I don't know what it was because I wasn't there at the time. But those types of attitudes made it that you were, quote, yellow peril. And then when the attack occurred, then it kind of verified or validated this concept of yellow peril, that, hey, these guys are really enemy. And so even if the nation of Japan is the one who attacked, they just made the assumption, but I think it's more of a political evil that made everyone that was Japanese associated with imperialistic Japan, which wasn't true. And yet political motives can create that hatred and all that. So that's essentially from the time that I got out of the prison camps, then that racial attitude of yellow peril never went away. And even in the 1990s, we would receive phone calls when we were in California. On December 7th, the phone would ring, we'd answer it, hello, and they would say, remember Pearl Harbor, and then hang up. And this occurred in the 1990s. So again, this thing of yellow peril never went away. So for me, all that in my career, I've experienced incidences, or even when I was going to school in Seattle, all the way through high school, and then went to college, I've had comments of, oh, you're a Jap, and that type of derogatory, racist type of remarks.
When you moved to Hawaii, did it help that Hawaii was a more ethnically diverse place? Did that help a little?
Huge, huge awakening for me. My wife, of course, was born and raised in Hawaii. And so when we got married, we would visit Hawaii several times. And I mean, I felt safe here. Really safe. And that was one thing that struck me, was that on the mainland, the Japanese were quiet and they didn't try to cause trouble, and we became, quote, model minorities. Whereas when I visited Hawaii, when we visited with my wife and kids, you look in the newspaper and hear Japanese people were committing crimes and all this, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, wow. But it's because of the higher percentage of Japanese that are in Hawaii compared to on the mainland.
I imagine seeing Japanese and other Asian names in leadership positions might have helped make you feel a little bit safer, or
yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like teachers. Yeah. My wife went to Farrington High School, and a lot of her teachers were Asian or Japanese Americans. When I went to school, there were very few Asian teachers. I can't remember any. They were usually secretaries in the schools. So that was one thing that really struck me about Hawaii. The other thing that was really eye-opening to me was when you go into a restaurant in Hawaii, people serve you. Whereas on the mainland, I had many times where people would ignore me.
Well, Ken, I think your story is so interesting. It started out in a very painful place, but it seems like you were able to make a very nice life for yourself and your family. Your book, Gammon, can you tell our listeners where they can get your book?
Yeah, it can be purchased on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. My wife and I also have what we call a Hui Manu Press. And if you go to ahuimanupress.com, our books appear. But if you order it on that, it goes directly to Amazon anyway.
Thanks so much, Ken.
Thank you, Russell. And thank you to Hawaii Public Radio for having me.
And that was our author, Kenichi Yabusaki, talking with HBR's Russell Subbiono. Yabusaki recently published a memoir entitled Gammon, and we will have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the next episode of our special series, Elements of Energy, cobalt and a new kind of slavery in Congo used to mine it.
Mining has taken over that entire part of the Congo, and there's just no other way for people to survive.
The human cost of cobalt mining. That's episode 3 of our week-long exploration, Elements of Energy, coming up on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929, for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the little red mask finch. This Manu Minute was made with field recordings from the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology.
The story of common waxbills is similar to that of many of our birds in the lowlands of Hawaii. Native to Africa, they were brought to Oahu as cage birds, where a few escaped and formed wild populations by the early 1970s. At only about 4 inches tall and weighing 8 or 9 grams, common waxbills are among the tiniest birds in the state. Both the males and females have a bright red eye mask and bright red-orange bills. The rest of their plumage is mainly grayish-brown, with fine black bars that you can only see if you get up close. Like many of the finches imported to Hawaii, they mainly feed on grass seeds. If you're driving along the road and see a flock of tiny birds clinging to the tall stalks of grasses, there's a good chance that some of them are common waxbills, especially if you hear their song and it sounds like this. Waxbills were first spotted on Maui in the late 1990s. On the Kona side of the Big Island in the early 2000s, and on the Hilo side just in the last 4 or 5 years. Now they're very common on both those islands, especially where there's tall grass, such as parks, open fields, and roadsides. They're a great example of how non-native bird species can quickly expand into unoccupied niches, especially in the lowlands, where we've lost most of our native bird species to introduced diseases. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, devoted to protecting endangered birds and plants on Hawaii Island. More about helping at friendsofhakalauforest.org.
This morning, I have the pleasure of introducing you to the new president and CEO of Hawaii Public Radio. Meredith Artley stepped into the job following the retirement of Jose Fajardo last month after an 8-year run here. Good morning.
Aloha. Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah. And, you know, I was here for 7 of those 8 years that Jose was here. And, you know, just watching the progress, you know, strengthening our signal across the state and really strengthening our newsroom have been two really key points in his tenure here.
He's incredible. And we're still in touch on a regular basis. So I know all the staff is grateful for that. And I know all of our listeners are grateful for his leadership of this remarkable team. I mean, this is week 3 for me, so I'm still figuring out where the light switches are, as you well know. But I'm just struck by this incredible commitment and creativity that you, Catherine, the conversation team, the whole staff have for what we get to do at HPR. And so I'm grateful to you and Jose and everyone who's built that. I mean, what a great essential public service this is.
Yes. And, you know, watching to see, you know, what Michael Titterton did, you know, before Jose Fajardo and the mainstays, right? A lot of our hosts who really helped to build this from the ground up.
Oh, man. I mean, It's great you mentioned Michael, too. You know, it's funny. I've noticed at different points in my career, and maybe you've seen this as well, where a new leader will come in, and it's almost like the past hasn't happened, right? They don't necessarily talk about the people and the decisions and the learnings that got whatever the institution is to where it is today. And when I stepped into this role, I really wanted to make a commitment to honor where HPR has been. I mean, it's one of the reasons that all of us want to work here, and it's one of the reasons that people love to listen to us and access us online and engage with us out in the communities. So just, I feel like it's one of those life leadership lessons, like acknowledge who has come before you and what they have built and build on that, you know, and don't ignore that, but just be grateful for it. So, yes, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, the arts are big in our programming, you know, with the classical side and all. And before you came here, you were the interim head over at the Doris Duke Shangri-La Museum.
Yeah, I had this kind of convoluted, wordy title, which was the interim executive director for Shangri-La and the executive in residence at the Doris Duke Foundation. And it was, you know, it's incredible. It's an institution, a different kind of institution in Hawaii. And just, you know, you've been there. We were talking about it earlier. And the stories, the complexities, the layers of Shangri-La are just remarkable. And they've got a great leader there and their new executive director, Ben Weitz, and the CEO of the Doris Duke Foundation is Sam Gill. I think he's in town because he's going to buy me a cup of coffee on Friday. So, you know, it's, I just feel like Shangri-La is a great example of other remarkable places in Hawaii that need to be increasingly for Kanaka and Kama'aina, you know?
Well, I shared with you when I was up in your office a little while ago that when I was a City Hall reporter, I remember doing a story about how Doris Duke had wanted to bring her 2 camels over from New Jersey so they could spend the winters here in Honolulu. But, you know, I think your time there, you've probably seen the complexities of life here in Hawaii.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so grateful to a lot of institutions for showing me, a lot of people first that make up these institutions, for showing me some of the complexities and layers of Hawaii. I'm still learning it. I mean, you know, I'm married to Naka Nathaniel, a remarkable columnist and editor at large for Civil Beat. And so through Naka and his family and his whole line through his dad going back in Hilo, you know, I've had a lot of exposure to the diversity and the things that are just not what you get on a postcard when you think about Hawaii. So I'm really grateful for that, for decades of that. And a place like Shangri-La that teaches you how to make something that's behind a gate that stands for wealth and opulence actually accessible and in service to the public, that's awesome. And a place like, I don't know, the Kauai High Canoe Club, where I spent a lot of time this summer. I don't want to brag or anything, but I did get a couple of medals, Catherine. So, you know, I think these places where you get to connect with different parts of these communities in Hawaii are just so vital and so important. And HPR is certainly one of those places where we get to bring people together and amplify and elevate voices and stories. And, you know, you and the team do an excellent job at that on this show.
Well, thank you. But, you know, you are a news lady, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about your background, about, you know, your work at CNN and in print and digital.
Yeah. So before Naka and Kai, our 15-year-old son, before we moved to the Big Island, our home base is Waimea, 2 years ago, we were all in Atlanta. I was with CNN for almost 13 years as their editor-in-chief and senior vice president. And, I mean, it's CNN. It's 24/7. It's global breaking news. It was intense and it was wonderful. And I really value digital as a technology that can help reach people in all different kinds of ways, and different stories can be told in different forms and formats. And so, yeah, that's something I definitely want to help bring to HPR, is this sense of, yeah, we're incredible on air, and we're also terrific and growing online and in person, too.
Yeah, I mean, I look at digital as a way to be able to extend the ripples out. I mean, people hear us, you know, our show on the airwaves, and they're driving, you know, on the Big Island from one side to the next, or here, you know, on Oahu when you're sitting in traffic. But yet, digital does have the tremendous reach all over the globe.
All over the globe. It's amazing. And, you know, one of the things, it's a long list. We need to do a whole show on it, Catherine. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's so amazing about HPR is, you and I were talking about this over a beer at the Pagoda, but I think our world is so fractured and filtered right now, digitally, right? Digital's not all great. And it's a big tent. But what HPR is a unifying, clarifying, and trusted voice. And that's what we can bring to everything we do, you know, on air and online. And so I'm just so excited about that. And I'm grateful for the serendipity that HPR provides. I mean, just look at your show today. What a range of rich, interesting stories and people and voices you do here. Mm. Just thank you.
It affects everybody. Yeah, absolutely. But thank you so much, Meredith. And I know you're only 3 weeks in, but we'll have you back on again.
Let's do it anytime.
All right. Thank you. We have been hearing from Meredith Artley, HPR's new president and CEO, who joined the HPR Ohana earlier this month. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow we learn about a 3-day music festival to help with Maui's recovery, featuring Mick Fleetwood and other notable Maui musicians. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.